Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And folks, it is now or never. And I can't emphasize that enough. As everybody's watching, you know, the descending of tyranny from digital currency and every other way around to Sunday, it's time for people to get up. As a matter of fact, I'll just say this one thing. It's time, because I've said it before, it's time we stop reacting and start attacking. And the petitions are the way forward. But anyway, we've got Paul, and welcome back, Paul.
Hey, thanks.
And so we were just talking about this little thing called common law. And so this was Mr. Pendleton that kind of brought this up. Now, we're going to find a citation a little bit later on, one of the reasons why George Mason actually, you know, was against the Constitution is because it did not declare and invoke common law. Yeah. But the bottom line is, it is not for the states, and that's the whole thing. The states were, when they determined common law to be the law of the land, it was their responsibility to maintain common law. The federal government was, based on the Bill of Rights, was equipped to basically deal with all cases in common law. But they weren't to establish it. It was left to the states. Go ahead.
That leaves me with a plethora of questions. I hope I don't mess up the time. But first of all, why wouldn't the federal government establish common law? What other choices were there?
Okay,
we've had other discussions, right?
Right. So the other choice was civil law. Okay, so they could choose civil law, which is Roman law, which is what the Catholic Church used. Common law is what Israel used. And so,
dumb question again. Why would they be given the choice? In other words, if there was something that I would think...
It's simple.
Go ahead.
So who is to determine what a state is to do? I've been saying this because this proves that if they couldn't determine the fundamental law system of a state, how is it that they could determine that one state would be slave and another state would be free?
Okay, so the states and the way that they defined state at that time was the way we defined nations. Okay,
absolutely.
They were individual sovereign nations, and we were a confederation of nations. And so obviously these nations would have the authority to determine what kind of law that they operated under. There was common law and civil law, and they were familiar enough with common law that they could put it into execution. So, but it leaves a lot of questions about where's common law today? If we're not using it, how do we get it back? Because I believe, you know, I know you've talked about Louisiana having parishes instead of counties and using something different.
Civil
now,
law.
I guess that's civil law.
Civil law, correct.
So why is it seems like all the other states are now using civil law?
Well, it's one of those things that if the people don't, you know, understand and protect it, as government starts doing things. You see, one of the things that state governments never did was they never said we're no longer going to recognize civil law or common law as the law of the land. They just started changing how they were instituting the law or what law they were basically deriving, or I should say, what laws or what type of law they were imposing. So they migrated away from common law and into civil law.
Okay, so they migrated without officially making it. So
right.
Let's take my state's Missouri. When they started, I guess I should could look in the Missouri Constitution and see if they stated the common law was the law of the state, or was it assumed? Because if they assumed it, then they could assume something different at some point, right?
Yeah, so what you'd need to do is you'd need to search for when Missouri and how Missouri declared common law as the law of the state. Now, I'm going to presume that that had to have happened under, and I'll honestly say that it may have happened under the territorial government.
Okay.
That during the territorial government that they established common law.
All right.
For the
now,
people.
Let me run something by you that I've had to deal with here. And that is if, if they had to determine what kind of law that they had, then for those people who argue about, was it drill assemblies?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Their argument is that maybe the state changed to when they became, with the, not, is it the, not the Assumption Act, the Act of 1871.
The Organic Act.
The Organic Act. So maybe the states changed with the Organic Act the type of law that they were supposed to use. In other words, and then they would give this argument that, you know, we incorporated and now we're not what we're supposed to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, it does. But see, the state just can't do that. When the state forms, they don't show me in the Constitution that the state has the ability to change its fundamental legal system. Would they delegate the ability to change that? No. In other words, it would have really required an amendment to the Constitution in changing your fundamental legal system to going away from common law. But common law was implemented and declared as the law of the land. They started realizing, you know, in the late 1800s and moving towards the early 1900s, that common law was a little problematic for them. Because it provided more power to the people through grand juries and so forth. And I should say more power at the local government level where the people had the most power. So when we look at, and you sent me, and I wish you'd send it to me again. I actually need to go through your emails. If I can't find it, I'll ask you to send it, because you said Bill Hermeson sent you when they actually made the edict of going away from common law.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find that.
Right. But the point is this is, I believe this was the federal court, the Supreme Court, that stated that they're no longer recognizing common law and common law courts.
Oh,
and
yes.
So the real question is, did this federal court have the ability to determine that? Does the Constitution delegate to Congress the ability to change our legal system? No, it's not. As a matter of fact, they were to support common law regardless. They had to support the states when they basically said we're no longer going to, you know, take or, you know, recognize common law courts. Well, that's when they basically mandated via the federal government for the states to turn their backs on this. And I believe that that was the institution of civil law and the rolling out of civil law throughout the nation, where there may have been states that have already started moving down that path. But when the federal courts basically said, we're not going to recognize common law cases anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes. Yes.
And so with that was a strict violation of the Constitution. They didn't have the authority to make that declaration. As a matter of fact, Congress does have the power to regulate the courts. And okay. so they would have needed Congress to do that, but Congress didn't have the power either in the Constitution mm-hmm. to be able, they didn't have the power to determine the law of the land. This is why when we read, when we get to Mason, this is why it is that important, because it's clear that the Constitution does not declare common law as the law of the land. It doesn't declare anything. And the answer from, I think, either Madison or Nicholas comes back and says, had they declared it, then it wouldn't have left the states any choice. That the states are to be free to determine what course and what type of state they want to be. The only thing mm-hmm. that is required of them is they must be Republican in form.
Mm.
That's clear mm. in the Constitution, but it doesn't say anywhere in the Constitution that it must be common law in form.
Okay.
It wasn't until the Bill of Rights that basically did basically force the federal government to acknowledge and take on common law cases. Because that's the Seventh Amendment. In all cases under common law. And so, mm-hmm. which means that, you know, we have a right for appeal, you know, to the federal government in all cases under common law for those things they would have jurisdiction over.
Okay.
And so anyway, I hope.
Well, we're going to, yeah, well, so what I'll do, we'll keep going. But at some point, I'm going to go do some digging, because when I look for common law Missouri,
uh-huh.
all the references are only about common law marriage, not recognized in Missouri.
Right.
So I'm going to have to do some historical digging, maybe even go to the state library or something.
Yeah, that's So here you go. The next one is on direct taxes again. See, they talk a lot about okay. taxes, but here you go. Let's dive okay. into this.
All right. A gentleman, Mr. Monroe, has said that the power of direct taxation was unnecessary because the imposts and backlands would be abundantly sufficient to answer all federal purposes. If so, what are we disputing about? I asked the gentleman who made the observation in this committee if they believe that Congress will ever lay taxes if the other funds are sufficient. It will then remain a harmless power on paper and do no injury. If it should be necessary, will gentlemen run the risk of the union by withholding it? I was sorry to hear the subjects of requisitions and taxation misinterpreted. The latter has been compared to taxation by Great Britain without our own consent. The two cases are by no means similar. The King of Great Britain has not the purse, though he holds the sword. He has no means of using the sword but by requisitions on those who hold the purse. He applied to the British Parliament, and they were pleased to trust him with our money. We declared, as we had a right, that we ought to be taxed by our own representatives, and that therefore their disposing of our money without our consent was unjust. Here, requisitions are to be made by one body of our representatives to another. Why should this be the case when they are both possessed of our equal confidence, both chosen in the same manner and equally responsible to us? I think he must be referring to the Congress. In this paragraph.
Well, both legislatures.
Both legislatures.
Right. So okay. both the state legislature and the congressional legislature. Right.
All right. But we are told that there will be a war between the two bodies equally. Hang on. But we're told that there will be a war between the two bodies equally our representatives, and that the state government will be destroyed and consolidated into the general government. I stated before that this could not be so. The two governments act in different manners and for different purposes. The general government and great national concerns in which we are interested in common with other members of the union. The state legislature in our mere local concerns. Is it true or merely imaginary that the state legislatures will be confined to the care of bridges and roads? I think that they are still possessed of the highest powers. Our dearest rights, life, liberty, and property, as Virginians, are still in the hands of our state legislature. If they prove too feeble to protect us, we resort to the aid of the general government for security. The true distinction is that the two governments are established for different purposes and act on different objects, so that notwithstanding what the worthy gentleman said, I believe I am still correct and insist that if each power is confined within its proper bounds and to its proper objects, an interference can never happen. Being for two different purposes, as long as they are limited to the different objects, they can no more clash than two parallel lines can meet. Both lay taxes, but for different purposes. The same officers may be used by both governments, which will prevent a number of inconveniences. If an invasion or insurrection or other misfortune should make it necessary for the general government to interpose, this will be for the general purposes of the Union and for the manifest interest of the states.
So clearly, they understood a few things. First mm-hmm. thing is, is it true or merely imaginary that the state legislatures will be confined to the care of the bridges and roads?
Of course they would.
And then later on he says, the same officers may be used by both governments, which will prevent a number of inconveniences. So who's ever collecting taxes for the state government, they'll use the same officers to collect the taxes for the federal government, such as the excise taxes.
Because that's the job of the militia.
Clearly, right? It was understood that they weren't going to create an enforcement agency.
Mm-hmm.
Further evidence that they weren't going to create an enforcement agency. And then, if an invasion or insurrection or other misfortune should make it necessary for the general government to interpose, this will be for the general purposes of the Union, for the manifest interest of the states. And that interposing would be the use or the calling forth of the militia to use them. Okay, so anyway, this is good stuff. I mean, it's, you don't find contradictions. When these guys were laying out these arguments, it's not like they were really trying to pull one, pull a fast one on people. They were really being very succinct and concise on, what these powers were, that they could only do these things, so forth and so on. Now, we're going to jump down because we're actually going to get into June 14th because nothing happened of interest on Friday the 13th. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Usually right. Bad things happen on Friday the 13th, but nothing really of interest happened on the 13th. So we skip a day, we go down to June 14th. And now here's a note from Mr. Madison, and this is the beginning of when hair is and fur starts flying. So,
ooh, okay. Mr. Chairman, let me ask those who oppose this part of the system whether any alteration would not make it equally or more liable to objections. Would it be better to fix their compensations? Would not this produce inconveniences? What authorizes us to conclude that if the value of coins will continue always the same, would it be prudent to make them dependent on the state governments for their salaries, on those who watch them with jealous eyes and who consider them as encroaching, not on the people but on themselves? But the worthy member supposes that Congress will fix their wages so low that only the rich can fill the offices of senators and representatives. Who are to appoint them? The rich? No, sir, the people are to choose them. If the members of the general government are to reduce their compensations to a trifle before the evil suggested could happen, the people could elect other members in their stead who would alter that regulation. The people do not choose them for their wealth. If the state legislatures choose such men as senators, it does not influence the people at large in their election of representatives. They can choose those who have the most merit and least wealth. If Congress reduces their wages to a trifle, what shall prevent the states from giving a man of merit so much as will be adequate compensation? I think the evil very remote, and if it were now to happen, the remedy is in our own hands and may by ourselves be applied. I don't know what question he's answering here.
I think the we'd have to go up, and it was Grayson that was speaking. And so my presumption was that they were going to create this lavishness, or in this case, he's basically saying the only way that these people could really be the elitist would be that they would have to make compensations so low that the only people that could actually fulfill these seats were those who had money.
Okay.
So we're talking about Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate, because compensation was being set by, as I understood it here, and as I understand it, they're supposed to have fixed compensation, and I believe it was the states that were supposed to determine.
Okay.
And so when they started increasing their wages, that's, you know, when the states, I guess, could have pushed back. But when you really look at it, the question is, what is the mechanism of making a person corrupt? In other words, if you wanted to open a door to actually start corrupting somebody, you actually have to have overpaying them. In other words, if we overpaid Congress, would they have the need or the desire to take, you know, bribes and so forth from other people? Well, yeah, possibly, but it would be harder to influence them.
Okay.
Because, you know, if they don't have wants, if they have, you know, more than an adequate salary and compensation, mm-hmm. then coming along and saying, hey, I'll give you money if you do something like this, or making them beholden to you because they need your money.
Right.
See, the difference is, if you underpay somebody, you actually make them more susceptible to the temptings of outside money.
Right.
Now, people think that it's, you know, we have a really good government when we have provide a trifling compensation for your state legislature and so forth. And I've always said that, you know, people have this all backwards. We need to make sure that people, I mean, would you take a job that underpays you for what you're doing? Heck no. Nobody would.
Not only underpays you, but imagine what legislators do. They meet only a few months a year. In the meantime, they are either have their own businesses or other jobs, and they have to go away from their own work to participate in the legislature. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
I do.
So what happens is, I kind of agree with you, and I believe I see it in my own state legislature that, you know, they ought to be paid more. I mean, these are people making the laws that attorneys make money off of, you know, arguing in court. Right?
Yeah, so one of the ways we kind of defer some of their costs is we pay for their assistance.
Correct.
I honestly believe that we shouldn't. I honestly believe that they should, if they need assistance, they should pay for what type of assistance they need.
And we should pay them enough to cover that.
Right. So in other words, when you look at a House of Representatives, you know, member in Congress, has 20 staffers, mm-hmm. and you look at how much money goes out to pay those staffers that we pay for, the taxpayers pay for, take that money away from those and say, we're giving it to you, and now we'll allow you to manage your staff. You can have whatever staff you want, but you pay for it. And I'll bet you anything, they won't hire 20 people. Right?
Right. That's awesome. I love that.
This goes down the path of spending other people's money. You know, sure. Milton Friedman gave the best insights on this. So we're going into break, as usual. Time flies. But Milton Friedman talks about how other people would spend money on lunch. If they're paying for it, then they're very frugal. But if somebody else is spending, and depending on who that is and why, it, you know, actually determines how much they're going to spend on lunch. And so when we come back, we'll pick up the next comment. And I believe that's George Mason. We'll be right back.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I don't know if we've kind of closed the conversation regarding compensation and paying people. But I think it is very clear that we do need to pay people appropriately. I don't think it's reasonable. I think it's, you know, actually it invites corruption when you underpay people. As a matter of fact, you know, if you look at, you know, a company that underpays people, that company may actually, because they have really lax security or what have you, the only reason those people stay there is because they can, you know, take advantage. Because there's no way you can actually employ people when you're taking advantage of them. And so, you know, you hear cases where, you know, people pay really well, but you can't take advantage of them. And you hear cases where people pay well and you can take advantage of them. And, you know, that's just stupid that, you know, companies don't have processes, you know. When we look at a retailer, why is retail so problematic of theft? Now, prior to the laws going sideways, the majority of theft came from the employees. And why would the employees steal from the employer? Because they don't feel like they're being fairly compensated. I mean, they could be kleptomaniacs, but 9 times out of 10, it's because people need something, or their needs aren't sufficient. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not some level of greed. That doesn't mean that there's not some, you know, ill thinking. But it has been proven that even good people, when it comes down to necessities and so forth, if they're having a hard time, and that happens to a lot of people, just because they've never managed money really well or what have you, they're baked into this problem of finances because they don't understand the importance of saving and those types of things. And so those people are always, you know, ripe with this, you know, stealing of, you know, things from their employer. Now, when I say stealing, I'm not talking about taking a pen home. I'm talking about, you know, taking, you know, goods, commodities, what have you, you know, away. So anyway, any questions on the compensation? I think we can shine a deeper light on this. And I'd love to if we pass the First Amendment, where we can actually get representation, you know, adequate representation, to where we're down to 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 people to a congressperson, and displace Congress out of D.C., then we take away their need to have to pay for a second residence. Their pay could go down dramatically. And then we still pay them. I mean, instead of paying them almost $200,000, we can pay them about $100,000. As a matter of fact, I believe that each state should actually set their own representatives. It shouldn't be uniform, because there's a difference there's a significant difference in the cost of living in New York and some of these other states compared to, let's say, Mississippi, Arkansas, and so forth. Does that not make sense? And you probably might be finding that you have to unmute yourself for me to hear you.
So I'm sorry. Yes, I did.
Okay.
I have to unmute myself. So real quick question. So, but doesn't the compensation allow Congress to set their own compensation? In other words, not. I thought I read, we read an article just a little bit earlier about compensation, and that it's wiser for Congress to set their own compensation than to have the states do it.
You know, right? I'd actually have to go into the Constitution and look for where they set the compensation, because I believe it does cover it.
Okay. Yeah, to some degree, I just it seems that it makes sense. Okay. For example, it would be far less expensive to live, for example, in West Virginia than in Massachusetts. Okay.
Okay. So,
so I don't.
This is where this is where it is right here. It's in Section 6, Article 1, Section 6. The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid out of the Treasury of the United States. So they so in other words, they do actually get to give themselves compensation. So yeah, they can adjust it. And I think that they played this game of trying to maintain a minimum. And as we went down this path, obviously it wasn't enough. For somebody to be sitting in that seat, you know, they probably feel that they, because they have a small, it's a small class of people. There's 545 whatever total senators and everything else, and the senators make more money than the the representatives. And as a matter of fact, I think it should be, well, actually, that's because the senators work more, are supposed to work more, but that doesn't pan out either. So I think everything needs to be reevaluated regarding compensation. And I honestly feel that this should, and I submit that, you know, as we start forcing the federal government back out, you know, to comply to the Constitution and have a virtual Congress or virtual representation, then I believe that the representation itself, so the senators may be able to have their own compensation set by them, but I believe that the states should actually set representation for their representatives. And buyer beware that if you undercompensate these people, they will become, you know, they'll be crawling on their bellies looking for, you know, money to basically ingratiate them so that they can, you know, not just get by, but have advantages. And that's what happens.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
Okay, so now we go down to this note by George Mason, right?
About the militia.
Yes, this is where it all begins, and this is where the fur really starts flying.
Okay, it says the militia and how to abandon it. Mr. Chairman, unless there be some restrictions on the power of calling forth a militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, we may very, very easily see that it will produce dreadful oppressions. It is extremely safe without some alterations. Oh, excuse me. It is extremely unsafe without some alterations. It would be to use the militia to a very bad purpose. If any disturbance happened in New Hampshire, to call them from Georgia. This would harass the people so much that they would agree to abolish the use of the militia and establish a standing army. I conceive the general government ought to have power over the militia, but it ought to have some bounds. If gentlemen say that the militia of a neighboring state is not sufficient, the government ought to have power to call forth those of other states, the most convenient and contiguous. But in this case, the consent of the state legislatures ought to be had. On real emergencies, this consent will never be denied, each state being concerned in the safety of the rest. This power may be restricted without any danger. I wish such an amendment as this, that the militia of any state should not be marched beyond the limits of the adjoining state, and if it be necessary to draw them from one end of the continent to the other, I wish such a check as a consent of the state legislature to be provided. gentleman may say that this would impede the government and that the state legislatures would counteract it by refusing their consent. This argument may be applied to all objections whatsoever. How is this compared to the British Constitution? Though the king may declare war, the Parliament has the means of carrying it on. It is not so here. Congress can do both. Were it not for that check in the British government, the monarch would be a despot. When a war is necessary for the benefit of the nation, the means of carrying it on are never denied. If any unjust requisition be made on Parliament, it will be, as it ought to be, refused. The same principle ought to be observed in our government. In times of real danger, the states will have the same enthusiasm in aiding the general government and granting its demands, which is seen in England, when the king is engaged in a war apparently for the interest of the nation. This power is necessary, but we ought to guard against danger if ever they attempt to harass and abuse the militia, they may abolish them and raise a standing army in their stead. There are various ways of destroying the militia. A standing army may be perpetually established in their stead. I abominate and detest the idea of government where there is a standing army. The militia may be here destroyed by that method which has been practiced in other parts of the world before, that is, by rendering them useless and disarming them. Under various pretenses, Congress may neglect to provide for arming and disciplining the militia, and the state governments cannot do it, for Congress has an exclusive right to arm them, etc. Here is a line of division drawn between them, the state and general governments. The power over the militia is divided between them. The national government has an exclusive right to provide for arming, organizing, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. The state governments have the power of appointing the officers and of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. If they should think proper to prescribe any, should the national government wish to render the militia useless, they may neglect them and let them perish, in order to have a pretense of establishing a standing army.
Okay, so here's some key points, because he's absolutely correct. And this is what they did. The states never held the federal government responsible for the equipping and what was all of that?
Equipping,
organizing, and disciplining. Militia. And actually funding the training. See, the training was supposed to be done under the states. So in other words, the states were supposed to do it, but if you look at, let me pull the Constitution up here, because this is in Article 1, Section 8, folks, and right. Says, Congress will have the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for the governing such part of them as may be employed in the service, reserving to the states respectively the appointments of officers, and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So, in other words, if Congress describes the discipline and standards.
Describing the discipline.
Right. In other words, the funding for all of this, the Congress was supposed to pay for all of this.
Right. And prescribe the discipline.
That's right. You know, and standards. So the whole point was creating standards, right? Everybody has this kind of weapon and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so, absolutely. So it boggles my mind. Why did the states allow the federal government to ignore and basically, like Mason says here, just ignore them and allow them to get outside of this boundary? Neglect, he used the words neglect them. And let them perish.
So let me ask you a question. From that time, in a historical basis, from that time to this, was there ever a time when Congress actively did this, you know, paid for the states to be armed and set standards for their discipline? Was there ever time?
So I'm presuming that you'd have to go to the Treasury and the outlays. But okay. That's what they should have done. And actually, the states should have actually forwarded requisitions to the federal government to say, you need to pay for this. And as a matter of fact, going back down to the training, you know, this is where the states should have implemented a training program. They could have actually created a basic school or academy in each of the states. And actually, if I remember correctly, every state did have, you know, some kind of academy. But it kind of went sideways when education was, you know, kind of abandoned even by the churches and everything else. But they should have probably created an academy in each state for their militia to where young men, at that point, not only young men, would be employed in the militia. So these young men of ages, let's say 14, they would start learning, if they hadn't already learned, you know, firearm safety, firearm handling, marksmanship, you know, the fundamentals of what they would need to do if by the time they turned 17, they would be ready to serve if necessary.
Right.
In other words, if had they created a plan to do that, remember the old, I think it was Reagan that said strength in a, you know, in a, what is it? Strength in an army or a, you know.
I know what you're talking about.
Right.
Peace through strength.
Peace through strength. Okay. So had we actually maintained, and right now, look how vulnerable we are. I mean, we do have people that have guns, and there's, you know, a lot of, but not enough. There's way too many people that don't have guns. It makes me sick when I watch TV shows where they talk, get that gun out of here. I don't want a gun in my home. And I'm going, are you kidding me?
Well, here's the other situation we're in. All right. There is, we've got this drumbeat against guns in this country, for one. So imagine what would it take to rebuild the militia? I mean, what 14-year-old at this point would we dare to even put in such an academy? I think there, at some point, it long-term thinking, if we have that much time, we need to prepare ourselves.
Oh, so to do this now, so to do this to go, now, we would actually need to start at kindergarten. We need to actually start training children that we all have a civil responsibility in supporting the Constitution, not government.
Sure.
And we need to be very clear about this. But see, this is why they've been teaching the antithesis of this. They've been teaching that, you know, we need to depend upon government to do these things for us, that we're not a self-governing body, you know, we're a democracy, but government does everything. And so government provides everything. They'll provide for our security. And basically, we abdicate our responsibilities. And so we have to go and undo all of that. And we have to really start at kindergarten in helping children understand that, you know, we are all citizens and there are these, you know, few obligations, but otherwise you have all of these other freedoms. And to we can't just wait till the age 14 anymore. And we have to actually get the only involvement the federal government should have in education at all is for militia training. That's it.
Right.
Not for critical race training, not for, you know, the sexualizing of your children and sex education. But that's what they've, if you look at the crap that comes from the federal government, it's absolutely abomination.
Sure.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, the feds are driving this. And one of the ways they're driving it is with federal funds.
Okay. Right.
Okay. And so instead of using, like you just said, instead of using the federal funding to wreck the family, they need to use the federal funding to strengthen the, how's the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state?
Right. To strengthening the sovereignty of each state and the nation.
Sure.
Right. So. Correct. Getting back to this, let me, because we want to jump forward, and this is what I need to make this connection. So George Mason just basically gave us the recipe of how they, you know, any nation, especially this nation, because of the way it was designed, could actually abandon the militia. But that abandonment, I got to be clear here, the abandonment of the militia, as done, as Mason laid out, was a direct violation of the Constitution because the federal government was responsible. So when the call comes, who should be spanked if we don't have a well-organized and well-disciplined militia? We should be spanking the federal government. Absolutely. Okay. So now the response, now this is the key thing. He's talking about the militia and, you know, the destruction of it and the danger of a standing army. This is what Madison says, because if you kind of look at how far this is from Mason, you know, actually click on Mr. Madison. Because
I am. He's talking about martial law, right?
Right. Or, well, actually, no. Go up. And actually click on the name Madison. And because there's no subtext for there.
Oh, okay.
I missed this one. And because this is about standing armies.
Mr. Chairman, I most cordially agree with the honorable member last up that a standing army is one of the greatest mischiefs that can possibly happen. It is a great recommendation for this system that it provides against this evil more than any other system known to us, and particularly more than the old system of confederation. The most effectual way to guard against a standing army is to render it unnecessary. The most effectual way to render it unnecessary is to give the general government full power to call forth the militia and to exert the whole natural strength of the Union when necessary. Thus, you will furnish the people with sure and certain protection without recurring to this evil. And the certainty of this protection from the whole will be a strong inducement to individual exertion. Does the organization of the government warrant a belief that this power will be abused? Can we believe that a government of a federal nature consisting of many co-equal sovereignties, and particularly having one branch chosen from the people, would drag the militia unnecessarily to an immense distance? This, sir, would be unworthy the most arbitrary despot. They have no temptation whatever to abuse his power. Such abuse could only answer the purpose of exciting the universal indignation of the people and drawing on themselves the general hatred and detestation of their country. You know, G.R., my observations, one of the beauties of the militia is that, and the two separate legislatures, okay, you know, the one representing the people and one representing the states, is that if there ever is a need to call forth an army, the states and the people have to agree in Congress in a declaration of war to send their sons and daughters into war. Okay, that, you see what I'm saying? In other words, to use the militia. What I'm getting from him and what I've always shared is that the militia is close to you. They're your family. You're not going to arbitrarily send them up. You know, let's say the people in Ohio where I grew up, we're not just going to take our militia and send them off to Ukraine. Why would we do that? Right?
Right.
It would not serve the purpose of the people, okay? In other words, and the army, you know, the army in, I think you've mentioned this before in your show, is actually, when it's constructed properly, is essentially a defensive force.
Yep.
Not that's someplace, correct. Right, not the world's policeman like we have been using it.
Right, that's the Navy's job. Everything external was left to the Navy.
Okay.
And the Marine Corps. Right.
Now that you bring that up, and you know, the Navy was essentially protect our commerce outside of our borders.
No.
If I'm not mistaken.
Well, so no. Yes, it does.
In other words, why would we be engaged with the Navy in wars with other countries, you know, except to protect our interests outside of our borders?
Okay, right? So that's correct, but you got to look, did the Navy fight, you know, when they went into Tripoli, who was used in Tripoli?
Oh, no. The Navy was the carrier. The Marines did the fighting.
There you go. So the Navy and the Marine Corps are the world, or is this nation's external forces.
Correct.
This is why the Marine Corps was always special operations capable. They were always the elite force, you know, where, you know, all special ops were done because that's what the Marine Corps did. And over time, the Navy felt a little, you know, sided that the Marine Corps commanded such respect, and so did the Army. Now, I know I'm speaking of this from a Marine Corps view because I spent that time in the Marine Corps. But why is it that these other services went around and created what the Marine Corps already had in its structure? As reconnaissance, we had Marine Corps Recon. And Marine Corps Recon did what the SEALs do. And they did what what the Army went out and did and what the Navy went out and did. And even the Air Force has gone out and created their own special ops, you know, team. And I'm going, you know, that was all redundant. And folks, this only proves how government will, you know, constantly justify spending more money to create, you know, more commands and duplicate and duplicate and duplicate when we don't need it.
Right.
Had we had the appropriate Marine Corps to, you know, to provide the services, and had we actually stayed within the confined concepts of not trying to finish wars. Not trying to do regime changes and those types of things, that really we should have just been guarding our interests. Now, when a tyrant actually invades Iraq, Iran invaded Kuwait, you know, we clearly found out that Saddam Hussein was horizontally drilling into the Kuwait, and then they invaded Kuwait. So, and Kuwait being an ally, or, you know, technically, we were kind of doing business with everybody until this aggression occurred, right? And so the only country in the region at that time we weren't doing business with was Iran, because they were directly hostile towards us. And so it's not like we had relations with Iraq. Why? Because they were Iran's enemy. And we kind of helped Iraq, you know, build themselves up so that they could actually keep Iran in check and or what have you. So anyway, I mean, we played some really stupid games there, but bottom line, when it came down to deploying any type of entity, we should have only deployed the Navy and the Marine Corps into the Gulf War. We should never have had a standing army. We should never created the standing military. But to be clear, if I go all the way back up to what Mason had said regarding a standing army, you know, and how Madison basically comes back to the standing army, as far as, you know, the king is concerned, this is the greatest evil, because this is when the king can enforce arbitrary laws, where, you know, he decides, see, I'm going to create this law, and now I'm going to enforce it. Paul, I'm sorry, we'll have to cut you off right here, because we're going into the end of the episode. So, folks, we will be back tomorrow. And we'll cover this more, and there'll be a lot more on the militia, martial law, and these types of things. And with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.